Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 18, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is a cyber strategy update with Robert Strayer. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. And today we are fortunate to have with us Robert Strayer, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Cyber and International Communications and Information Policies at the U.S. Department of State. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Robert, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Micah. I want to thank the Federal Society for inviting me to participate in this teleconference and for all of you for joining. I thought I would give about 15 minutes of opening remarks to explain what I do at the State Department, what our office is doing in the area of cyber policy, and then hopefully have enough time to answer plenty of your questions. So my office covers a broad spectrum of cyberspace policy issues and internet policy, ranging from how we cooperate with allies to counter cyber attacks to promoting the free flow of data that really underpins our digital economy to engaging with industry on a number of issues, including emerging technology regulatory policies. It's important that we work across the board of all of the cybersecurity as well as the digital economy issues to ensure that we're protecting the United States and our allies, and that we truly continue to benefit from the model of the internet that we have established in the United States and really that the world has adopted. We need to do that to ensure that we continue to reap the benefits of the internet and massive amounts of innovation that we've seen over the last few decades. It's becoming clear that almost every significant national security and economic interest is in some ways impacted by our larger digital ecosystem. So just as we deal with all other important transnational, international issues, State Department is involved in those discussions, and we use our diplomatic tools as well as all tools of our national power to ensure that we're advancing our interests in cyberspace and the digital economy. So I want to talk about sort of two main legal documents and policy documents that we've worked on in this administration, first being our national cyber strategy, and the other one being Executive Order 13800, which is our cybersecurity executive order titled Strengthening Cybersecurity of Federal Networks and Critical Infrastructure. That executive order was issued by the President in May of 2017, and over the course of the next year, we produced a number of reports under that executive order. Of course, as the executive order is titled, it focuses on strengthening the security of our federal government networks as well as our national critical infrastructure. But there are two important components that the State Department was the lead in drafting and collaborating with all other relevant agencies in the federal government in producing reports. One was an international engagement strategy. And that international engagement strategy has sort of two main prongs. The first being that we want to enhance the resiliency of our global cyber ecosystem, meaning that we want to ensure that countries can improve their abilities to identify, detect, respond, and recover from malicious cyber activity. Because we know that in a moment, instantaneously, we can have a cyber threat in one part of the globe reach another, it's critical that we work with partners and allies and all countries really to reduce the amount of malicious cyber activity that can affect us within our borders. So we want to ensure that no nation is a safe haven for cyber attackers. That means ensuring they can develop capabilities to respond to those threats, to receive threat information, process that and take action, as well as share threat information themselves. The other main component about that capability building is that we need countries to have a legal framework in place so that they can investigate, prosecute, and in some cases extradite cyber criminals. There's something called the Budapest Convention that went into effect in 2004, and that has served as a framework for improving cybercrime capabilities across the globe. There's roughly 70 countries who have acceded to the Budapest Convention, and about 60 more countries use that as the framework for their laws. Now, under this prong of the executive order, this report on international engagement, the other main part was increasing our ability to respond to nation states. improving what we call cyber stability among nations by reducing the risk of conflict stemming from cyberspace. And how we get at that is over a number of years, roughly in the last decade, we've sought to establish the applicability of international law in cyberspace. So just as in the physical world, international law applies concepts of sovereignty and non-interference with the internal affairs of a country that also should apply in cyberspace. We've also established through a mechanism at the United Nations roughly 12 norms of responsible state behavior. These norms were agreed to by the countries that participated in what they call a group of government experts process. This group of government experts included Russia and China. And then in subsequent General Assembly resolutions, those norms were agreed to and amplified. The important part of these norms is probably the most important one would be that nations should not seek to disrupt or to destroy the critical infrastructure of another country. That could sort of be seen as the golden rule in cyberspace. So as part of our efforts under the executive order and what later became the National Cyber Strategy, we at the State Department led an effort to draft a national deterrent strategy in cyberspace. That became another report that was filed within the executive order reports, but it also forms what they call Pillar 3 of the National Cyber Strategy, the international engagement prong. And that's where we are looking at what we need to do to deter other nations. We know that these norms of responsible state behavior and applicability of international law alone are not sufficient to deter nation states from taking advantage of cyber capabilities. They see them as asymmetric tools to achieve ends that they could not otherwise achieve in the areas of national security and economic capabilities. So they use cyber in ways that will seek to advantage themselves, as well as in political and military areas. So knowing that those norms are not self-enforcing, we've come to the judgment that we need to have an ability to change the risk calculus for other countries to affect their cost-benefit analysis of this by increasing, not just as we have in the past, our defensive capabilities, but to work on what kinds of swift, transparent, and costly consequences we can bring to bear to convince the decision makers in other governments that it's not worth using these cyber tools that could be destabilizing, disruptive, or destructive. To do that, we need a much broader set of consequences. For many years, of course, we've had diplomatic tools that we've used, including using attribution. We've also used sanctions policy, but there's a broader set of tools that we could bring to bear to influence decision makers in other governments. We also realize that to have greater impact and greater legitimacy to our efforts, it's important to work with other governments to do attributions together and then bring these consequences to the table. So we've been working with other governments to align our policies in this area. And lastly, we need to message this to an adversary so that they know that there are activities that if they conduct, they will be responded to in a way that brings forward consequences that make them reassess whether they want to undertake that type of activity given the costs. So that is the rough outline of our national cyber deterrence strategy under both the National Cyber Strategy and within the executive order on securing cyberspace. You know, this isn't just a conceptual effort. You know, since 2017, we've had two very significant destructive cyber attacks between WannaCry in May of 2017, which was done by North Korea, and in June of 2017, which was the NotPetya attack by Russia, which originally started in Ukraine but quickly spread around the world. Both of these disrupted critical infrastructure, and it was, you know, sort of very foreseeable outcome that that would be what would happen with the type of malware being used. We saw shipping and transportation systems disrupted. We also saw manufacturing of pharmaceuticals and the just basic access to hospital computer systems disrupted by those cyber attacks. We saw a great deal of coordination among countries in addressing those problems at the time, but later we also had a great deal of cooperation in having countries join together and doing joint attribution to the countries who had conducted the cyber attacks. the high water mark, I think, of our coordination on attribution was when Russia sought to undermine the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. We had more than 22 governments join together in the attribution of that cyber attack. So building on those attributions, we can now seek to implement consequences against malicious actors in the future. And another area that I wanted to touch on was we continue to talk to governments in an area where we're not just talking about improving our cybersecurity, but also protecting human rights in the long term, protecting our data, and ensuring that we have regulatory policies that meet our goals. And that is with regard to fifth generation of wireless technology, or 5G. 5G, you know, to sort of give a just more general statement about the technology, is going to be providing massive throughput of data with very low latency, and that is the delay, and it will also connect tens of billions of more devices. When all these devices and sensors are then interconnected, it's going to empower a whole new set of critical infrastructure. So everything from autonomous transportation networks and autonomous vehicles to telemedicine, because you'll have the sensors on the quick processing of data, to having just our traditional critical infrastructure in the form of electricity and water supply being provided over the top of the underpinning of the data transmission that will occur through 5G. 5G really will be about all of the critical infrastructure that is very important to our daily lives. So with that truly significant amount of critical infrastructure at stake as 5G develops, we really need to make sure that that is something that cannot be compromised by a foreign adversary. There are, of course, some very important cybersecurity practices that can be built in or are being built into fifth generation of wireless networks by the telecommunications operators. But one also needs to look at the adversary, the threat that could be coming at us. And with regard to that, we know that there are certain vendors of the 5G equipment and software that are in China, and they are under Chinese national intelligence law and other laws. The Chinese can direct the activities of those vendors without judicial review, sort of an extrajudicial mandate. And that gives us great concern about the ability for those vendors to be required by the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party to take actions that are not in our interests or in the interests of our foreign partners. As our societies become more and more interconnected and global supply chains are more interconnected, a disruption to the supply chain or activities in another country would almost immediately have impacts in the United States as well. We're also very concerned about the ability of a government like China to acquire data from those networks. We know they could exfiltrate data. It could be personal data, also could be commercial data. In the past, of course, China has conducted one of the largest schemes to acquire intellectual property, commercial data, through the compromise of global managed service providers and cloud providers. We, along with the UK and a dozen other countries, last December attributed the APT-10 group in China to China and to the compromise of these managed service providers, which were used to compromise then the clients of those providers, which were truly the biggest companies on the globe. And the access to their data then was then used to be shared with Chinese companies. So we know that China has a track record of using data or seeking to acquire data for its own commercial purposes. We also know that in the case of the Xinjiang province in China, that China has used data and technology to surveil their own people, a minority group called the Uyghurs, to determine what kind of activities they're engaged in, to suppress their freedom of expression and freedom of association, and then to now send more than 1 million Uyghurs to re-education camps in that province. So with the lack of an independent judiciary and independent judicial review, controls of data, we're very concerned about how China might in the future, with the ability to acquire massive amounts of data from us and our partners, proceed in ways that would undermine fundamental human rights. And I guess the other two things I should mention is that, you know, as our response to the United States are not just a diplomatic effort around the world to talk about our concerns and to talk here in the United States about them. We have on May 15th, President Trump signed an executive order that will allow us to secure our information communications technology networks from technology that is controlled by adversaries. That is a roughly 5-month period then where, under that executive order, that the Secretary of Commerce will develop an interim final rule to implement that objective. The second legal action was with regard to the company Huawei. The Commerce Department on May 15th added Huawei to what is known as the restricted entities list, which requires that someone exporting technology from the U.S. to Huawei needs a license from the Commerce Department. So those were two sort of legal actions that are part of our overall effort and concerns about Chinese technology and Huawei. So happy to answer any questions anyone has. Look forward to hearing your questions.
Thank you, Robert. While we let those question lines fill up, Robert, did you want to talk a little bit more about what the 5G issue means in terms of global policy and falling behind amongst competitors like China and Russia and how that works?
Yeah, sure. Happy to have to answer that. So, you know, about a year ago, there was really not much discussion about 5G supply chain security. Of course, as what 5G will be has come into more crisp focus because of the standard setting bodies completing their work, as well as an understanding of how critical infrastructure will be able to use these sensors and devices provided by 5G connectivity. We now realize the stakes are very high. So we've set out on a diplomatic campaign around the globe, including spending a lot of time in Europe with our partners there talking about our concerns to sort of lead them on and bring them along with us on an education path to better understand what 5G means and the security risks that are there, as well as the ability for a government like China, given their legal system and sort of lack of independent judiciary, to direct companies to undertake actions not in their interest or in our interests. So that's generally how we've approached this as a diplomatic effort. I mentioned those other two legal tools that we'll use. No company in the United States, none of the major four providers of wireless service in the U.S. will use an untrusted vendor, will use Huawei or ZTE. And last year, Congress passed a law through the National Defense Authorization Act to prohibit the federal government from purchasing any technology from Huawei or ZTE. So we've taken some pretty strong measures against those companies to protect our networks, and we're encouraging our partners to adopt similar measures to protect their telecommunications networks. So at this point, we really see a lot, hear from a lot of countries that say, yes, we understand that there's a true supply chain security risk quite apart from the normal cybersecurity issues that are important to think about when you're developing a telecommunications network. In fact, more and more countries are saying they at least want to exclude Huawei and ZTE from the core of their telecom networks and only allow them at the edge or periphery. And I just dive into that just for a minute. The distinction between the core and the edge of a 5G network really is vanishing. It used to be that all the real computing power in a telecom network was in its center, in its core, and that where you were closest to the user with antennas and radios connecting to, you know, handset devices was more or less not a dumb connection. It wasn't something that was had computing power really facilitating it in a real way. But in 5G, because critical infrastructure needs to have very low latency, that is low delay, the computing power needs to occur right where that critical infrastructure is, right next to the user. So really the whole network will have smart components distributed throughout it. There really won't be a distinction between the critical and non-critical parts of a 5G network. So we say anywhere in that network needs to be secure, and there's no place in that network for untrusted vendors that could gather data in ways that I described earlier to exfiltrate it or to cause a compromise of that critical infrastructure through the actions of an adversary with remote access. So I hope that sort of gives you an overview of our efforts there.
Absolutely. And we will now go to our first question.
Hey, Rob, this is Megan Brown over at Wiley Ryan. Thanks for taking the time to do this with the Federalist Society. I was wondering, since you've been generous enough to do this, if you could comment a bit on the challenges you guys see from the fact that a lot of this international norm building in cyber can't be really talked about that easily publicly, and sort of the disconnect there and your perspective on what challenges that poses for you guys to drive norms forward while only being able to really talk about a portion of what is going on from both a positive and a negative perspective, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, Megan. Yeah, thanks a lot for that question. That is very insightful, and that is one of our challenges for sure, is our ability to talk about what we do in cyberspace. Well, one thing we do is we try to be as transparent as possible, and of course there are limitations, but that's why we think it's very important to put out reports under this executive order, to we obviously have a national security strategy, but to also have a national cyber strategy nested under that. We have a Department of Defense cyber strategy. I think we're one of the few countries in the world to have a public national cyber strategy from our Defense Department. So we try to explain our doctrine and our methodologies about how we view cyberspace to be as transparent as possible, even if we can't talk about particular operational activities. We talk about how we view cyberspace, what principles we want to apply. Another thing that's important is that there's something called confidence-building measures that are used in a number of other areas of international policy to try to establish trust between countries and to address any concerns or potential escalatory activity that's occurring. So in cyberspace, we've gone around to a number of different regional forums and also at the United Nations to talk about the confidence-building measures that could help in cyberspace to help nations understand each other's activities and have a better lay of the land as to how they approach cyberspace.
All right. We'll now move to our next question.
Hi, this is Carter Page. I'm curious to know what reaction you've gotten with respect to the problems that occurred in the State Department and the FISA abuse during the Obama administration. I'm wondering if you've noticed when dealing with a lot of other countries around the world, whether there's been any backlash related to that, given the corruption that occurred during the 2016 election, and any response you've received.
Yeah, thanks, Carter. Thanks for that question. I actually, to be honest, haven't really been on the front end of that that issue from our foreign partners or them asking about it. I think they probably, if I had to speculate, are directing those questions to the Department of Justice. I understand that, I've read the papers, I understand kind of the background on this, but it hasn't really come my direction.
Not seeing any other questions roll in right away. Did you have any closing remarks for us, Robert?
No, I just appreciate everyone's time, and reach out to me directly, the State Department, if you like. I'm always eager to have input from others' thoughts on particular issues. We cover a vast array of policy. I just tried to touch on two relatively, I think, interesting topic areas for folks, but working on a bunch of other things. So feel free to reach out at any time and provide your thoughts, or if you have questions about it, let us know you need to know more about. So really appreciate everyone joining today.
Absolutely. And on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.